Hey everyone, welcome back for another deep dive.
Always exciting to dig into some new research.
You know, and today we're looking at what happens after a wildfire. Like, how does a forest bounce back?
Yeah, it's almost like watching a whole new forest kind of rise from the ashes, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we've got this super interesting research article from the Journal of Vegetation Science.
Oh, yeah, I saw that one.
It's all about how the severity of a burn, you know, how bad the fire was.
Right.
And the soil chemistry. How that impacts what plants grow back first.
It sounds kind of complicated, but the study is fascinating. They focused on the largest wildfire in Sweden in over 100 years.
Wow, over 100 years.
Yeah, it burned over 32,000 acres.
So in a fire that huge, you'd think that the areas that burned the most severely would have totally different plants popping up afterward.
You would think that, right?
Compared to like the lightly burned zones.
Exactly. That's kind of the common sense assumption. But in this case, burn severity wasn't always the most important factor.
Really?
Yeah.
So what else were they looking at then?
Well, they wanted to isolate the impact of burn severity as much as possible.
Okay, makes sense.
So to do that, they focused on clear cuts.
Clear cuts.
Within the burned area.
Oh, interesting.
So places where all the trees had already been harvested.
Ah, so they were creating a level playing field.
Exactly. They took light variation out of the equation. No tall trees blocking sunlight or any of that.
I see.
They set up 80 plots across these clear cuts and tracked them for 5 years.
Wow, 5 years.
And recorded which plants popped up and how the soil chemistry changed.
5 years? For a forest that feels like the blink of an eye.
Yeah, it is a pretty short time scale.
Did they actually see significant changes in that short period?
Oh, yeah. There were some pretty dramatic shifts.
Hmm.
But here's the thing. It wasn't all about burn severity. It was almost like a game of chance. You know, like which seeds landed where.
Oh, wow.
Which ones got lucky and sprouted first.
So it's not just survival of the fittest. It's almost survival of the luckiest.
Yeah. Think of it like a lottery for plants. And those early winters, they have a huge impact on what the forest looks like later on.
Makes sense. So random events can shape the future of a whole ecosystem.
It's true.
But what about the soil? I mean, wouldn't you expect that to play a role too?
Absolutely. The fire must have done something to the soil chemistry, right?
Yeah.
So they looked at it, all pH levels, nutrient content, everything.
Okay.
And it turns out soil pH did have a minor effect.
Okay.
But overall, soil chemistry wasn't the big player they thought it would be.
Interesting. So we've got burn severity having some impact, a lot of randomness thrown in, and soil chemistry taking a back seat.
It's shaping up to be a pretty complex picture.
Where does that leave us then?
Well, it leads us to one of the most intriguing findings. The trees, the forest was primarily pine before the fire, but guess what started coming back strong?
Well, if it was pine before, maybe another evergreen like spruce or fir?
Good guess. But actually, it was deciduous trees like birch and aspen.
Deciduous trees. So we're not just talking about a few saplings here and there. This sounds like a whole shift in the makeup of the forest.
You got it. And that got the researchers really excited.
I bet.
Because these early changes, you know, those seemingly random events and these new trees taking over, they could have a domino effect for years to come.
It's like a whole new chapter is starting in the forest story.
Mm-hmm. I'm dying to know more about how these early events play out over time.
And you're in luck. Because that's exactly what we're going to explore next. We'll dive into some of the plant characters, the fireweed, the blueberries.
Okay, you've definitely piqued my curiosity, listeners. We're about to meet the stars of this post-fire botanical show, so stay tuned. Welcome back. We left off talking about how the makeup of this Swedish forest was changing after the fire, with lots of birch and aspen popping up.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable.
But let's back up a bit. What were some of the first plants to appear in those clear cuts right after the fire?
Well, some of the same plants found in the unburned clear cuts were also in the burn areas.
Really?
Yeah, it's just that the amounts were different.
Ah, so it's like a reshuffling of the deck.
Exactly, and the competition was fierce. Makes sense. I guess those first plants to emerge may be pretty tough to survive a fire.
Absolutely. Take fireweed, for example.
Fireweed.
You know that beautiful pink wildflower that pops up after fire?
Oh, yeah. I always thought it was ironic that something called fireweed would show up after a fire.
It does seem counterintuitive.
It does.
But the name is spot on. Fireweed is often one of the very first plants to colonize burned areas.
Okay, that makes sense. But didn't you say fireweed doesn't have a seed bank?
Right, no seeds stored in the soil waiting to sprout.
So how does it get there so fast?
Fireweed is a master of air travel.
Air travel?
Those fluffy white hairs on its seeds, they act like tiny parachutes.
Wow, so they just float on the wind.
Allowing them to travel long distances.
So fireweed is like the plant world's ultimate wanderer.
Exactly, a perfect strategy for colonizing disturbed areas.
So we've got our airborne fireweed traveling on the wind. What other kinds of plants were they seeing in these early stages?
Well, in contrast to the free-spirited fireweed, there's the blueberry.
Blueberries. I bet they're a lot happier in those less severely burned areas.
You're right. Blueberries tend to do better where the fire wasn't as intense and they have a different survival strategy.
Oh, how so?
Blueberries have this secret underground network that helps them survive.
Underground network?
Yeah, they have these extensive underground stems called rhizomes.
Rhizomes.
They store nutrients and allow the plant to spread horizontally.
Okay.
So even if the top part of the plant burns, the rhizomes can survive underground.
So they're like the plant version of if you can't handle the heat, get out of the kitchen.
Perfect analogy.
And this strategy isn't unique to blueberries, is it?
Nope. A common grass in these forests. Deschampsia flexuosa.
Deschampsia flexuosa.
It also has rhizomes.
So both the blueberries and this grass have a way of weathering the storm.
Right. Diversity in survival tactics is key.
Like having a diversified portfolio, but for plants.
Exactly. Some play it safe underground while others take a chance and travel by air.
That's a great way to put it. Okay, so we've got our airborne travelers and our underground survivors. Are there any other strategies out there?
Well, don't forget about the plants who are all about preparation. Some plants, like a flower called Cinesia sylvaticus, they rely on having a stockpile of seeds in the soil.
Oh, so they're like the botanical preppers, all stocked up and ready for anything.
I suppose you could say that. And fire can create ideal conditions for these seed bank species.
How so?
The heat can trigger germination, and the lack of competition gives them a chance to thrive.
That's pretty clever. But wait a minute. Didn't you say earlier that this Cinesia sylvaticus actually declines after a few years?
Yes, that's right.
If it's got this amazing seed bank, why doesn't it just take over?
Well, that highlights an important point. Even the best survival strategies don't always guarantee long-term success.
Wrong.
It's all about timing competition and a changing environment.
So it's not just about having the right traits. It's about having them at the right time.
Exactly. In the case of this flower, it's a fast-growing annual, meaning it completes its life cycle in a single year. It capitalizes on the open space after a fire grows, quickly produces a ton of seeds, and then it's done.
So it's a boom and bust strategy.
That's one way to put it.
And that's why these post-fire plant communities can change so dramatically.
It's a constant dance between different species.
Now let's get back to those trees.
Yeah.
What about the birch and aspen that started taking over after the fire? Why were they so successful?
Both birch and aspen produce a lot of very light seeds.
So they're also playing the wind dispersal game, just like fireweed.
Right. And they have another advantage. They can resprout from damaged roots or stumps.
So they don't have to rely solely on seeds.
Exactly.
Double whammy. Seems like they've got all the bases covered. What about the pines, though? Why are they less successful?
Pines typically rely on seed dispersal for regeneration. Their seeds are heavier and not as easily carried by the wind.
So while the birch and aspen are already setting up shop, the pines are waiting for the wind to catch them.
It's not just about speed, though. Pines are adapted to drier, nutrient-poor soils, and they can live much longer than birch or aspen.
So it's a trade-off. Fast and furious in the early years versus slow and steady in the long run.
Exactly. And that's why it's so important to study these post-fire successions over longer timescales.
Right. This is like the first act in a much longer play.
Mm.
But are there any species that are totally wiped out by fire?
That's a great question. But it's hard to say for sure based on this study. Remember, they were focused on clear cuts,
right,
which had already been impacted by logging.
Okay.
There could be species in the surrounding untouched forest that weren't able to establish themselves in these more open, disturbed areas.
It makes you think about how resilient those untouched forests might be.
It does. And remember, even though many of the same plants were present in both burned and unburned clear cuts, the amounts differed.
Yeah.
And those differences in abundance could have long-term consequences.
Right. It's not just about who survives, but how many of them there are.
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting when we start thinking about how to manage forests, especially with fires becoming more frequent. We'll dive into that next.
Great. I'm ready to tackle those management questions. Listeners, we'll be back to talk about the implications of this research and what it all means for the future of forests. Welcome back to the show. We've been talking about this mega fire in Sweden and how plants respond in those early years after a fire, but let's zoom out a bit. What are the bigger implications of all this? I mean, why should we care about what's happening in some clear cuts in Sweden?
Well, forest fires are becoming more and more common all over the world. Think California, Australia, the Amazon, and climate change is a big part of that.
So it's not just a Swedish problem, it's a global one.
Right. And as we've learned, these post-fire forests can be pretty unpredictable.
It makes you realize We can't always control nature, even if we try.
That element of chance, which seeds land where which ones sprout first, it really changes our assumptions about how forests regenerate.
But we do manage forests, right? We plant trees, we try to prevent fires. How does this research play into those management decisions?
It challenges us to rethink our approach in the past. We often focused on restoring a forest to its pre-fire state, you know, planting the same types of trees that were there before.
So instead of trying to rewind the clock, maybe we need to be more flexible.
Exactly. This research highlights the importance of understanding those early stages of succession, which plants are coming back on their own, which ones might need a helping hand.
But we also talked about how fire can lead to changes in the dominant species, like those deciduous trees taking over from the pines that could have some big implications down the line.
Absolutely. Think about wildlife habitat. Different trees provide different things for different animals.
And what about carbon storage trees? Play a huge role in absorbing carbon dioxide, but different species store different amounts.
Right. So even from a climate change perspective, understanding these shifts in forest composition is crucial.
And what about the people who live near these forests? I mean, forests aren't just ecosystems. They're part of our communities.
That's a really important point. People might have strong feelings about what they want their forests to look like. They might value certain species for aesthetic reasons or for their cultural significance. Forest management isn't just about ecology. It's about people, too.
So with climate change throwing more curveballs our way, like more frequent and intense fires, managing forests is only going to get more complex.
It definitely adds another layer of complexity.
So how do we even begin to make sense of all this? I mean, this study was focused on clear cuts in Sweden, a very specific type of forest.
But remember, even though the setting was unique, the study highlights some fundamental principles of post-fire succession, the importance of seed dispersal, the role of resprouting, the boom and bust cycles of certain species. These are all processes that play out in forests everywhere.
So it's like a blueprint for understanding how forests recover from fire, even if the details are different.
Precisely, it gives us a framework for asking the right questions, for observing the patterns, and for making informed decisions about how to manage forests in a world that's increasingly shaped by fire.
Okay, that makes sense. But you also left us with that final intriguing question. What might be different in a natural forest recovering from fire compared to a managed forest like a clear cut?
Ah, yes, that's the million-dollar question. Unfortunately, we don't have all the answers yet.
Oh.
But we can make some educated guesses. Natural forests tend to be more complex with fallen logs, standing dead trees, and a wider variety of plant species.
Right. Those were some of the things the researchers were trying to eliminate by focusing on clear cuts to simplify the experiment. But in a natural forest, those elements would all be part of the recovery process.
Exactly. And each of those elements could create unique opportunities for different plants. For instance, those fallen logs can act like little nurseries, providing moist, sheltered spots for certain seedlings to get a foothold.
And those standing dead trees could be nesting sites for birds, which could then bring in seeds from other areas. It seems like that natural complexity could actually make a forest more resilient.
It's certainly possible a greater diversity of plants and habitats could provide more pathways for recovery, more options for adaptation, but we need more research to compare different forest types and their responses to fire.
More research, always more research. But that's what makes this so exciting. There's still so much we don't know.
Absolutely. And the more we learn, the better equipped we'll be to manage and conserve our forests in the face of these growing challenges.
Well, listeners, I think it's safe to say our brains are full of fascinating forest facts. It's been quite a journey exploring the aftermath of this mega fire and all the factors that shape a forest's recovery.
It's been a pleasure, and hopefully this deep dive has sparked your curiosity about the resilience of the natural world and the dance between disturbance and renewal.
Definitely. I know I'll never look at a burned forest the same way again. So the next time you see a scorched landscape, don't just see destruction, look closer. Observe the plants that are coming back and think about the forces at play. You might be witnessing the first act of a botanical drama that will unfold for years to come.
Well said. Keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep into the mysteries of the natural world.
That's a wrap for this episode. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll catch you next time.